your hands. So remember, help your loved ones, and they in turn will give you blessings. So he goes in detail, and in the middle of the trance, Bob, he takes his shoes off or something, and he says, I removed my shoes in the dark, it's in the dark, and crept out into the middle of the room when the trumpet levitated. I felt someone's foot and squeezed it. So it was so dark, nobody knew that there was someone in the middle of the room holding the trumpet. So Bob recognizes the trick, and he says, then I returned to my chair. After 3 hours of sitting and listening, the seance finally came to an end. Yet, Kenneth was still tied to the chair, and he looked exhausted. So what happened is the next day, Kenneth calls up Bob Carr and wants to meet with him. They meet, and I'll read there the first part of the encounter. Ken said, I think we have something in common, and smiled. At the same time, looking straight at me, he said, quote, I hear that you have some psychic gifts, too. And then Bob says, well, not like what you do, I said. And then Ken says, what I mean is, we are all trying to help people and teach them so much more than what they get from just going to church. All of that is so limited. And then Bob says, yes, realizing that was his agenda that he wants to believe in. And I guess Ken goes on. Kenneth, he says, you know, religion is so narrow and is full of closed views. It has done much harm in the world, keeping people from knowing the truth. Bob says, yes, that's right. We all know of the exploitation and the fears that the control religion has over people's lives. I think there's something on your mind, Ken, I said. And then Ken says, yes. What did you think about the seance last night, Ken asked. And Bob said, it was quite interesting, and it was curious what happened last night. Ken looked again at me, but there was no smile on his face. He asked, what did happen, Bob? Bob says, well, you know, you're psychic. You tell me. Ken shifted his position and leaned over closer to me. I said, quote, this is what Bob says, look, Ken, I really don't care at all. To me, it doesn't matter. So then Bob says to us, the reader, I think I gave him an opening. So Ken replied, you have to sometimes help the spirits. Mm-hmm. I truly believe in my work, and to help other people, you sometimes have to, and then Bob interrupts and goes, yes, I understand what you're saying. So Ken is feeling guilty that he knows that Bob knows that he cheated, right? And so this little drama goes on. And I won't go into... Ken gives his history of how he became psychic. Reverend Alice discovered him and blah, blah, blah.
Reverend who?
Alice. Reverend
oh, yeah.
Alice.
Okay.
Does that sound familiar?
Yes.
Yeah. And discovered him when he was 17 or something and naive and he took development classes. Okay. He says, well, soon after that, I started reporting to... Okay, Reverend Al says, Ken, you know you have to... Okay, this might be interesting. When school was out, I worked on the railroad, and the job was very tough. I felt like an outsider, and the men...
This is Bob talking?
No, this is Ken. Kenneth Richards, Kenneth Reinhardt.
He says what? No, go back again.
Yeah, he says, when school was out, I worked on the railroad, and the job was very tough. I felt like an outsider, and the men made fun of me all the time. I didn't fit into their world. I guess that's why I got interested in all this spiritual study. I also gave sermons at the little church, and people thought that I was gifted and that the spirits were working through me. As for the psychical phenomenon, nothing was happening. I sat every night to help develop my powers. One night, Reverend Alice, that was her name, said, Ken, you know you have to help the spirits. Ken says, that was a shock to me, what she said. She patted me on the head, and then Ken says to her, I think I understand. And then he says, well, soon after that, and he's telling Bob Carr all this, well, soon after that, I started reporting to members of the church that a spirit guide had made contact with me and was helping me in my mediumship. Soon I was developing psychic powers and started to give little seances. Spirit voices were speaking through me. Then there was materialization from ectoplasm coming from my body, and there were levitation and trumpet voices. And so Bob says at that point, well, one has to do what one can. Now, I was just thinking, maybe he changes the name because he could get sued by Reinhardt. Maybe that's a factor.
I don't know whether Reinhardt's still alive.
Oh, okay. All right.
But he could be.
Maybe
he has
family.
Had this church on Capitol Hill, but I think that was founded before Bob set up his on Capitol Hill in Seattle. So his juxtapositioning it down to Portland and everything and changing his name is kind of like holding the cards close to his chest.
Yeah, because when Bob said...
unless he starts telling about the transition to Seattle by both of them.
No, he doesn't bring him up anymore.
He doesn't? Okay, but he was here first.
Yeah.
Reinhardt was here first, I think.
Yeah. Well, see, what's interesting is that Bob is...
With the church.
Yeah. Bob is... What's interesting is Bob is...
Which was called the Aquarian Church, by the way.
Oh, okay. Well, what's interesting is Bob Carr has explained to us, the readers, why he's moving out of being a medium, and he's got a conflict about it, and he's reading Krishnamurti, and he's given an example of a guy who's a successful medium and how Bob thinks it's a bit ridiculous and doesn't really help people. He goes on about that later.
Uh-huh.
But so the point is that Ken...
But, see, now, technically, the dating is that while Bob was at the Center of Integration and giving all kinds of trances for
quite some
time.
No, not the center. Not the Center of Integration. This is 53, but down in, at the center. It's just called...
Yeah,
the
I know, but at the, up at the Center of Integration, after he'd done this quite a bit, one time he had an experience... on the inner plane where he was told never to do it again. And so he didn't, except for that final one, and he had a grudge against anybody who did do it.
That's
and
right.
So when I started doing it, he thought, oh, you're not supposed to do it. I was told from the other side, you're not supposed to do it, and you're doing it, and... I don't know, David, you know.
That's right. Now, Dave, that is exactly my experience the day that I met him and Connie. That was the issue. It came up. He started making fun of you right in front of me. I don't know if Carolyn was there, but I remember visiting there, and we went upstairs later and saw the all the paintings and that they use in the slideshows, all the little slides and pictures.
Yeah.
But my only encounter with him, my main memory of it was him disapproving of what you were doing. That you're right.
And now you know why.
Yes. Yeah, that's good.
Because he was told not to do it so nobody else could do it.
That's right. And now, so what you saw, you get there at the Center of Integration, you see his last trance, and you must have found out earlier or around that time that he'd been doing a few before you showed up, right?
Oh, they had all kinds of transcripts and everything else and all kinds of people talking about it. They had... talked about it very little when around me because he hadn't been doing it for quite a while. That's about all I heard was people complaining because he hadn't been doing it. And I didn't know what the hell they were talking about. And then they said, well, now he's going to do one. So I was going to be in on it, but I was only in on the last one,
which was
a pretty good one.
Yeah, which I find interesting is that that's a very experience that I know you had. When you stopped in 74, 75, everybody's bugging you. Dave, come on, channel awareness again. Remember that went on for years.
Uh-huh.
It's similar to what he went through. And but I'm not saying it's exactly the same, but he goes through what you go through later. It's different. It's not, the content is not the same. But
I understand.
It's like Bob is acting out your life before you go through it, when you meet him. And you're
one of those cycles.
Cycles, and you're both thinking about Krishnamurti very deeply while you're doing it,
Yeah.
Okay, so he says, so he makes Kenneth feel relaxed. He goes, well, one has to do what one can. So he says, Ken seemed relieved and more relaxed, so that all he wanted to know was just, are you going to tell on me kind of thing, And Bob was cool about it. He didn't care about the whole scene anyways. He was like leaving the psychic scene. He didn't care. He says, Ken seemed relieved and more relaxed, but Bob says, I was fascinated by his story. He'd found someone to share his never-told secrets with. I was not his enemy, nor did I condemn him for his tricks of the trade. Later, Ken told me that there were open... and closed mediums, that the open ones shared their confidence with their fellow workers in the spiritualist world, and that the closed mediums never told anyone what they were up to. Then Bob says, I thought about how everyone wanted to believe in magic. It is so deep-rooted in our nature. What's interesting about Bob, when you read his biography, he has the Krishnamurti and then the later anti-Krishnamurti view filtered from the beginning. You see that he's detached about all the stuff that he did. And, and you find out later when he gets very involved with Krishnamurti and then the anti-Krishnamurti.
Which Krishnamurti?
The first Krishnamurti, J.K. first,
yeah.
And Jito, and then the U.G. Krishnamurti, the what's known as the anti-Krishnamurti. His initials
now,
are
who, puts the name anti? I said anti-Krishnamurti, but is anybody else?
Yes, yeah, so Wikipedia, he is known as the anti-Krishnamurti.
Oh, okay, okay.
And
okay.
The anti-guru and everything. But it's interesting. Bob is writing this book, you know, and way...
The only thing is, when does he get to Seattle?
Well, it's coming up in the next chapter. Here it comes. This is his last encounter in Portland. He's already going up to see people in Portland, right? More than once.
In Seattle, yeah.
Yeah, in Seattle, not Portland. And he's talking about closing the center. He finishes up with Ann Love. And then he goes and he spends several pages describing in detail Ken. And it's very important because this is the psychic medium world. And this is the kind of dinky world down in Portland that Bob is showing us he's leaving.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean?
I think there's possibly a juxtaposition of time that some of these events and interchanges happened in Seattle, with Reinhardt, where he's putting now maybe they did meet in Portland, but Reinhardt was Seattle based.
Yeah, and maybe you know he's putting this Reinhardt relationship in the book, but he's not going to develop it and. But he's putting in there because it does unfold a lot of stuff that happens in Seattle that you know about and other people knew him back then knew about, but he's not going to spend much time in the book writing about it.
Kind of interesting.
Yeah, but he does stick it in as an archetypal moment for him.
Yeah.
He says...
That part is authentic, but not necessarily in Portland and not necessarily at that particular time, but after he moved up to Seattle.
Yeah, that's why.
Anyway,
like,
go ahead.
That's why I like going through with it because I think I have a sense sometimes his timing is off, and we will see that in the next chapter, I think. And that's why we're going through with you. He says, I thought about how everyone wanted to believe in magic. It is so deep rooted in our nature. We left the restaurant and went our separate. See that kind of detached statement? He goes philosophical. Everyone wants to believe in magic. It is so deep rooted in nature. He'll make statements like that all the way through, from a detached perspective, so to speak. We left the restaurant and went our separate ways. When I got home, I sat down and thought about our conversation. This is what he thought. Am I any different from Ken? We are all in the business of giving people what they want. Some hope to escape from the pain of their lives. Of course I'm different. I don't bring back the dead and make people think they're talking to some dear departed ones. What I'm doing is altogether different. I help people to understand themselves and to learn how to make their life more. That's what he's saying. He's thinking to himself.
He's channeling something, but not other people's spirits.
Right, but you will see later that he would acknowledge that he's just trying to make himself think different. And that's what he will say later. Because he said, I sat there in the silence for a long time, mulling over the events of the day and the previous night. So he's ending this whole chapter, it's called The Beginning of the Center. He hasn't even got to Seattle yet, but it's called The Beginning of the Center. But it's all about him encountering this other guy who's starting a center himself, right? And doing tricky mediumship. So he begins the next chapter, and this is the chapter before the one that really gets us into Dave Worster. Chapter 6 is called Friday Night Was Flight Night.
Fright Night.
Yeah, he is FL. You say FL.
I know, but... He's got another connotation with the guy, the CIA man that was giving us the sessions called him Friday Fright Night.
Right.
But go ahead.
Okay, we'll get to that. But the chapter before that, he starts off saying, I was now spending more time in Seattle, with a Mrs. Groger, G-R-O-E-G-E-R. Ever heard of that name? Mrs. Groger or Grieger?
Go ahead.
Do you recognize the name Grieger or Groger?
I'm trying to think.
Okay.
Go ahead and see if there's something else.
So what happens is she comes, introduces herself at one of the sessions he does in Seattle. And she met Ramana Maharshi. Maharishi or Maharshi?
Maharishi.
Yeah, he leaves the I out. And so, but before she studies at his ashram in India, and was under his spell, but before leaving India, she travels to Kerala and came to know a man called Swami Ramdas. She told me that he was now coming to Seattle on a world tour and that I should meet him. Ramdas, she said, was full of God intoxication and expressed his love and devotion to God. So Bob says, well, I thought, this sounds like Ramakrishna. My experience with the Vedanta Center is over, but perhaps I should go and see what this Indian master has to say. And it's right at that time.
And now where is this, in Portland or in Seattle?
This is in Seattle, but he hasn't moved there yet. He's just about ready to move. He's starting to do these meetings in Seattle, but he hasn't moved there yet. And we're after the chapter, the beginning of the center. You see, the beginning of the center, I thought, was about the center of integration, but it's about the center in Portland in the early 50s.
Mm-hmm. Then there was the center that Grace Chapman opened up that he closed down and moved. So it's like how much
we'll get
he
to that.
Says about, he might have been staying at the place that was Grace Chapman for a while some of this is happening and then shifting over.
So, yes, no, that's what's going to happen. You're right. And it's in this chapter. So the title, the beginning of the center to me, I read that first because I thought it was about the center of integration, but it's not. It's about the events in Portland mm-hmm. when he had the Portland Center, but they are important to leading to the development of the center of integration.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But what happens when he's going back and forth and he's thinking of somehow doing more in Seattle, this woman introduces him to this guy, Swami Ramdas. But he says... he's thinking of going to see him, but he says, I felt there was a conflict among the different elements within myself. First, the work that I was involved with, my own and others' use of the revelations that were coming out of me. He had a conflict about these revelations, him and the others. That would be, I guess, Kenneth Reinhardt. Second, or other people in the center. Second, my own past, the lifestyle that was still hidden away from those who attended my psychic demonstrations or readings. Now, it's funny. I had not read the first chapters where he talked about as a teenager how he became a homosexual or went into that lifestyle a little bit, and I don't know why he's not talking about it when I'm reading the later chapters first, and so I don't think he's admitted.
You miss it.
Yeah, so I miss it. But while I'm reading it, he doesn't go into it. He says the lifestyle that was hidden, even though he sort of implied it at the early part of the book, here in chapter 5, he's still... Like you say, the gaff, he's holding it close to his chest, even in talking about it in the
book.
Yeah,
and so he remembers, and he's essentially telling the truth, but he's playing it close to the chest on some things, and maybe just juxtapositioning some time, space, energy, and names, but it's essentially all there.
That's right. Like, because I had not read the first chapter where he talks about his homosexual encounters, in detail, he's had them and he's excited about them. I started reading the book from chapter 4 and moved on.
How come you did that?
Because
that's the one where it says it's the center and you went right to it?
Yeah, I didn't think
okay.
I didn't find his writing interesting at first. It was boring, and so I just wanted to get to the details and prepare for it. On some level, he's a terrible writer. I mean, it's ridiculous. When he goes traveling, he says, "Oh, we went to Nice, France, and they have wonderful buildings there." Then we go over to Switzerland. Oh, wonderful Alps! It's just surface, no description of details of the traveling. Just that we went and we saw some people, we had dinner, and we said goodbye. I mean, that's absurd in its simplicity. But anyways, so I was not encouraged to hear about his life when he was young. But I was puzzled that he was not talking about too clearly. And when he meets Connie, he doesn't talk about any sex he has with him. And he talks.
Incidentally, the night that I saw him at Reinhardt's where he read auras.
Yeah.
Connie was there for the first time, and he said, I've got to meet this guy. And so he went and met Robert and went home with him that night. I was in on the other side of the room. I didn't even know that he was there. Just later, I was telling about it. Oh, he's reading auras. He says, yeah, I was there. Oh, I says, oh, that's where you met? Well, wow.
Yeah, and there are, we'll go into that. It's great that you're saying that, because he does talk about first meeting Connie, but it's not in that way. He didn't talk about that way.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So it's like he's talking about his life with Connie and then life with this guy, Paul Arms, and it's like they live in separate rooms and there's no sex going on. It's funny. He implies that they might be having sex and they're lovers, but he's also has affairs with girls, with women in between. So he kind of keeps it slightly hidden or something. It's not blatant.
I don't know about the girls, how many he had. That seems strange, but...
Oh, he had a
with
relationship.
With all the stuff they did and all the places they went and all the rest of it, you never know.
Yeah, I will give you the name of the woman. It has her picture in here. This is in the early 70s, and her name is Cindy Shivers. Mm-hmm. You ever heard of... Did you meet her in 69? Cindy Shivers? Doesn't sound familiar. Okay, that's when he was with her, supposedly, when I met her. Okay, when I met him. Okay, so what...
Really?
Yeah, I met him in 69, early 70. That's when he's with her.
Well...
There's a picture. Well, let me check. It might be 1970, 71, because it's a picture of her when she is in 69. So we'll check that when we get to it.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So he's saying that he's having this conflict. Second conflict, my own past, the lifestyle that was still hidden away from those who attended my psychic demonstrations and readings. Third, my adventure with the Vedanta teachings that were steeped in tradition. And fourth, the most important new interest in Jiddu Krishnamurti and what he had to say about the whole pursuit of and search for spiritual enlightenment. All this is conflicting him, the Vedanta, the Krishnamurti, his lifestyle, and his being a psychic medium. Then he goes... Now, we can look up the date. I think First and Last Freedom comes out in 55, in my memory. It's around mid-50s. Because he says, the First and Last Freedom, a new book by my new hero, opened up so many new ideas that seemed to be so right and clear as the man's situation and how he had created all the problems in the world. The traditional approach seemed dead, with little life in it when viewed through Krishnamurti's insights into the nature of mankind. He rejected all paths or systems of religious practice, everything that I had been doing. My interest in Vedanta, with all its rituals, now seemed dead. I could not go back to any belief in a guru or follow some idea, Western or Eastern system of thought. I saw the need to reject everything and take on the problem of knowing oneself by being free of all beliefs. A tall order for anyone to accept, but that was the starting point. In one sense, I felt a split. A conflict I must come to understand by myself. So he had to understand it by himself, this conflict. I could not rely on anyone to help guide me on my quest, including Krishnamurti himself. As the years passed, I would come to know the impossible task. Read that again. As the years passed, I would come to know the impossible task Krishnamurti asks each person to undertake. It's like what you were saying before we started taping about it's a horrible thing to ask someone to become aware.
Well, yeah, I mean, because of all that they have to do to actually accomplish it. It isn't just, you know,
a weekend.
So it's like if they're already moving toward it, then you can guide them. But look at the energy it takes to get somebody to go down to that level and follow them through. I mean, think if you had somebody you did it with, it'd take you half a lifetime to get halfway there.
That's right. Yeah. Okay. I think they once, Zappa said in an interview once, somebody was amazed at all the intricate thinking in his music that he normally never talked about. And they said, well, how come you never talk about that to anybody? He says, I just would be too tired. It would just take too long, he said. It would exhaust me. So anyway, so he says it's a real problem to ask someone to become aware, so to speak. At this point, I never really questioned the man. So he's saying years later, he saw it was an impossible task, what Krishnamurti was asking. But at this point in 55, I never really questioned the man, as he spoke with an authority that I could not deny. Now, see, that sentence, when you're first reading this and you don't know the story of the anti-Krishnamurti, you say, oh, isn't that interesting? He's implying that Krishnamurti failed, so to speak, or this impossible task. And he admits that from the later perspective. He says, at this point, in 55, I never really questioned the man, never really questioned Krishnamurti. You know what I mean? Later, he comes to question Krishnamurti, which is interesting, which we'll get into later, because that part you may not know about. You may not know that part of himself.
Well, I think I heard some, but...
But it was definitely triggered by the anti-Krishnamurti, UG Krishnamurti.
Well, I think that when he was in India...
Yeah, in 66 the first time.
Huh?
Yeah, he went there in 66. We'll
66, you're right.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so, yeah, we'll get to that.
Wait a minute, 66?
Yeah.
He had come back...
He comes back in April...
66. He came back in 66.
No, he goes... I don't know if you know this. One of the old women from the center days, probably
yes.
Center of Integration, left some money to him and Connie in her
one will. 19th of her fortune. She divided her fortune up into 19ths.
Right. So
and she gave, I think, she gave 3/19ths to Bob and 2/19ths to Connie.
Right.
And on that basis, they
left town.
They
in the spring of 66. They go and they spend their way almost a year until they come back April 67. But they spend time with Krishnamurti.
So they weren't there in Ojai in 66.
No.
That's right.
But they were with Krishnamurti in December in Rishi Valley.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
I know that they went to dinner by Maharini, which had many guests, and Krishnamurti was one of the guests. And when they talked to him, he invited them up to the school, and they spent some time up there.
Right, they go into details, so we'll get to that. So he says here in 55, with all the kinds of thinking going on within me, I ask myself, should I go see this Swami Ramdas? Is there some urge in me to question what I believe? Who am I to question another who claims to be in an enlightened state? Yes, I will go and see this man and find out for myself the answers to my question. So he sort of didn't want to go to Gurus anymore, but he said, I'm going to go anyways. So he says, on returning to Portland... Okay, wait a minute now, does he goes... Yes.
To Portland to see Ramdas.
No, he's in Seattle. I think he comes back to Seattle. Yes, he comes back. So he's been given the offer, and the guy is coming in the near future. You know what I mean? He's not there right then. Like she says, the woman, Mrs. Groger says... He's now coming to Seattle on a world tour, and I should meet with him. But that's in a little while, a couple weeks or something, right? So he's doing his Seattle sessions as a guest up there. So he returns to Portland, and he mentions people you know or heard of. He says, on returning to Portland, I called my friends David and Betty Shreve.
Yep.
Who were involved in a new system of counseling people. They had a large house that served as a meeting place and included therapy rooms. David, that's not you. Sorry. It's funny, David shows up the name in his life a lot. So David Shreve had been through the whole gamut of do-it-yourself psychotherapy and now was teaching his own version of it. I thought David would like to see a real Indian holy man. They both agreed to go and suggested we drive to Seattle together. So I called Mrs. Groger to tell her of our plans, and she informed me that Ramdas would be staying at a hotel near the University of Washington. Back home in the Portland Center, Nellie was there, and Anne had moved out. So see, Anne is gone. So everything was in order. I would go with David and Betty in their car, but come back on my own, as they can only stay for a day. So he calls Wally Cunningham, who kind of got him into the Vedanta Center, or did get him into the Vedanta Center in the beginning, to tell him that he was going on, to tell him what was going on about my one-night adventure with the spiritualist. That would be Ken Reinhardt. He laughed at my description of how I crept out... Wally laughed at my description of how Bob crept out into the room and felt Ken Reinhardt's feet. Wally was not interested in Ramdas, but he asked me why I was going to see him. Well, Wally, I don't want to miss a thing. If there's one thing for sure, it is that I want to meet an authentic man, I replied. So he goes up there, and they go to the Olympic Hotel, and he has a whole encounter with Ramdas. He's very impressed with him. He really feels he's something amazing, and he says... On his way to meet Ramdas in the hotel, a small, slight Indian, Swami Satchidananda, who was traveling with Ramdas' party, asked me to follow him into the next room where Mother Krishnabi was sitting on the floor. She He greeted me with a smile. Her face looked calm and serene without a trace of anxiety. So I'm wondering if Mother Krishnabi is the famous mother of the 70s at whatever that temple was that William Irwin Thompson got visited. I can't remember. I'd have to look it up later. So he's very impressed with this guy. He's impressed with Ram Dass. When I returned, Ram Dass invites him to come to India and visit his Ananda ashram. When I returned to Portland by train, I spent the next few days and nights tussling with what Jay Krishnamurti was saying as opposed to what Ram Dass was teaching about spiritual practice and the search for enlightenment. You know, Ram Dass gave him a mantra and all kinds of stuff. At the end of my struggle, Krishnamurti's ideas went out. I wrote to Ram Dass after he returned to India and told him of my interest in Krishnamurti and said that I would not be coming to India. So he's not going to go and study with Ram Dass, right? Later, you get that, Dave? You're following me?
Yeah.
Later, I received...
I still don't know what date this is.
This is 55.
55, all right.
54? No, it's... Sorry, it's 54. It's...
All right, that makes more sense because he still is getting ready to come to Seattle to establish the Center of Integration.
Yeah, and it looks like he established the Center of Integration. He doesn't call it the Center of Integration at first, but he establishes it in 54, okay? So this is just as he's ready to come, and he says, I wrote to Ram Dass after, so this could be early, late 50, early 54. I wrote to Ram Dass after he returned to India and told him of my interest in Krishnamurti and said I would not be coming to India. Later, I received a reply from Ram Dass asking me to stick with the teachings of Krishnamurti, as he was an enlightened man, says Ram Dass. So that is the big turning point, because he goes, Bob says, so that ended my uncertainty. It became clear that I was not interested in the traditional approach. The traditional ideas dropped out of my mind along with the mystique of India's spiritual teachings. And then he goes on, here's what happens. The power of one's imagination is compelling. One evening, one of the students attending the center, this is in Portland, asked me about my visit with Ram Dass. Her name was Margaret. And they get... Okay, her name was Margaret, and she was about the same age as I. We went for a ride in her car and parked on the outskirts of the city. She had been driving, and I was sitting on the passenger side in the front seat. As we were talking, I suddenly felt a strange current of energy in my body. As I sat straight against the front seat, I felt the force move up my back through my heart and up to my head till it reached the space in the middle of my forehead. Then it burst into a golden ball that opened like a flower. And there in the center was a golden figure, and I knew that was what I was, a pure being, light. Was this the self the yogis talk about? I was transfixed by the experience. A bright light that was self-luminous lit up the whole front of the dashboard in the car. Then it was over, and I returned to a near-normal state of mind. So I don't know if she saw the bright light. He saw the light in his mind, or it happened right in front of them. He said, what is that?
Transition of perception. Yeah, so his perception moved to the point, and of course it lit up everything.
Yeah, because it's going up his head, then it burst into a golden ball, and then it becomes self-luminous and lit up the whole front of the dashboard.
Because of the transition of the internal senses into, like, through the third eye.
Right, and so Margaret may not have seen it.
Possible.
Yeah. He goes, then it was over, and I returned to a near-normal state of mind. Margaret and I both stayed up the whole night just feeling a state of peace and love. I don't know if that means she saw it. The hair on the back of... But she was aware that he was having some kind of experience, I guess. The hair on the back of my neck was full of static electricity. Margaret felt that she was in love not only with me, but also with all of life. Early in the morning, she dropped me off at the center, and I told her that we should get some sleep. The next afternoon, she called and said that she must see me. I told her that I would come up to her apartment that evening. There, we talked a great deal about our experiences. So she was getting affected maybe by... the Ram Dass guy, too. But anyways, we talked a great deal about our experiences. I could see she was thinking about forming some relationship with me. Well, one thing led to another, and I spent the night with her. You see how casual he goes, one thing led to another, and I spent the night, I fucked her. You know. I could see she was thinking about forming some relation with me. Well, no details necessary. One thing led to another, and I spent the night with her. Then he says, the next morning, in the light of day, I knew that I was not in love with her. Again, it was sex for sex's sake and nothing more. In a way, I had just misled her and abused her trust. She felt something for me, but it was not love. It was just part of our heightened state. That state came to an end, and so did my feelings of love. I was not ready to commit myself to any firm relationship at all. I was much too self-centered and wanted to be free to live my own life as I saw fit. I find that interesting.
Repeatedly.
Yes, I keep doing this.
Checklist. We're adding up the number of women.
That date,
right on.
I'm the ultimate bureaucrat.
Incident.
Yeah. I'm a chartered accountant of spiritual experience. I'm an auditor of spiritual experiences. Yeah, and also I'm counting the number of times he has a relationship with a girl. Now, could this be the part of himself that would have a heterosexual relationship keeps translating into the mystical intensities, and he can't handle women, you know?
Uh-huh.
Is one to get psychotherapize it, you know? What do you say to that? Is that a problem?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I just figured all these might have been men by another name, but I don't know.
These might have been men. Yeah, because... He's going out.
I know.
No, but he's going out with men all the time, and he's not worrying about sex for sex's sake. It's only with women he starts worrying about sex for sex's sake and nothing more.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he just realized he just can't.
Well, because they really don't want to have sex for sex's sake. They got a hook.
Yeah. You mean, who's they?
The women.
Yeah, women, right. He says that was that, not.
It's not a foregone conclusion, but it's a tendency.
Yeah. Yeah.
That they put one and one together and make two, and you say, no, I'm still one, you're one.
he says, I was much too self-centered and wanted to be free to live my own life as they saw fit. Now, the next paragraph begins. Grace Chapman, one of my new friends in Seattle, was determined to move my center and myself to Seattle.
All right. Does he give a date?
No, but now you think, now this is, I think, based on what you said an hour or two ago, you think the later he moves from her place to Capitol Hill, but he says here she had found a large home in Capitol Hill. That's the first place.
Yes, that's where her place was, the first place he went.
Oh, okay. I thought you were saying he moved to Capitol Hill after leaving her place an hour ago.
Then he did. He moved to Capitol Hill, and that was where the first center started. But then when she started pulling certain things, then what he did is he checked it out, and he went to a lawyer, and he had his whole thing made out the way he wanted it, and Grace didn't want it that way. And so what he did is he took all the money out of the bank account and moved over to what became the Center of Integration.
Yeah, which address is near the...
957 Broadway North.
It says, yeah, and remember, he had a center on Broadway in Portland, same name, Broadway Street. Unless he screwed his memory up, is it
no.
Broadway? There's a Broadway in Portland?
Yeah.
Okay, he says this, after he leaves Grace's Capitol Hill, he says he moves to a house near the Theosophical Library and Volunteer Park. Does that sound like?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay, so what's the name again, the number? 957
Broadway North.
That's 14-7 is 21, or it's 14-7, take away the 7, you get 7. That's interesting. Okay, so he says, she found a large home in Capitol Hill, a very nice part of the city, and asked if I would please come to see it. She was ready to buy it and turn it over to me as in my new home and center. I had to make up my mind. I felt that leaving Portland would be easy. See, so we've had a whole couple chapters talking about how he's disconnecting from Portland. I could make a clean break, and I would take Nellie with me. So he does bring Nellie up there. He says, moving would give me a new option, and I could create a real center. Dave, you're crackling the line.
All right. Thinking.
Anyway.
How's that?
Yeah, if you don't move.
That reminds me of the time I told.
Yeah. Okay.
You don't want me to repeat it?
No, not yet. No, hold that. I just want to get this. Moving would give me... It's interesting how he does come to Seattle with the Krishnamurti as his motive, as his mentor. You know what I mean? He gets through all this earlier stuff, and then he comes to the Center of Integration as a Krishnamurtiite, because he says, moving would give me a new option, and I could create a real center for what I thought was the right approach to living. I went to see Wally to talk over my new plans. He thought that the move was a really good idea. He told me that he would take some time off and help me with it. So Nellie agrees to go. Everybody agrees to go to Portland. and
from Portland.
Yeah, and, I mean, go to Seattle from Portland, and Wally helps. And there's a guy named Wayne Cook. Did you ever meet him?
Wayne Cook is a familiar name. Now, tell me about him.
Wayne had been to Korea in the war and was a bit confused about his life at that point. And I, of course, was stirring up his feelings about religion, God, and sex. It seemed they all went hand in hand. Then Bob says, only later would I learn that they were really all the same.
Yeah.
Religion, God, and sex.
And hand to hand.
Yes, yeah. Wayne could take a couple days off for the trip. When we arrived in Seattle, Grace organized the house. So he spends a lot of time with Wayne, but nothing triggered there, eh?
I don't know. I know his name, and maybe I saw. Maybe he came and went at the center later.
It says here, Wayne was new to the spiritual search. I had saved him from the Southern Baptist Church. We spent a lot of time together skiing at Mount Hood and relaxing in natural hot springs on an Indian reservation in the Oregon Desert. But I guess that was before they became Seattle. So sometime in this period, he's skiing with Wayne. So I was happy in my new abode and felt that it would be the start of something new, not only for me, but also for Seattle. See, so he's on a mission to bring something new to the spiritual community in Seattle. I would help break the inertia of Seattle. He says, I would help break the inertia of Seattle's spiritual community and awaken the true spirit of religious thinking. Here I had an impressive stage from which to present a new approach to spiritual understanding. The group was the core that could be organized to help fulfill my dreams. I would try my best to create a real center for all to come and join in a new adventure. So you see the... that's why it's interesting that he...
All right, but that's still a Chapman's place.
Yes, and what's interesting is that he's, from what you're saying, even though he started, he's doing a Krishnamurti thing, he still, though, does some meetings in Seattle in this period, it seems, right? He still does...
Well, go ahead and continue.
He says, we set an opening date for the new center. We thought that we would simply call it the center. The schedule would offer a Sunday morning talk, an open session for my psychic readings in the evening. So, yes, he was doing his psychic readings right there. And a Thursday evening class based on the work. I'd forgotten that sentence. So he was doing psychic readings in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
Phyllis Goodall would be my secretary. Phyllis Goodall would be my secretary and help with my readings that were to be the core of the center's teaching. Phyllis also took a room on the second floor as a getaway place in which to do her writing. Grace was to be in charge of running the house. And another friend, Marie Hawk, would be treasurer.
I remember her.
Nellie was somewhat depressed by the move, and she felt out of place with the new group. I had complete freedom to come and go as I liked, but I kept a close eye on how things were working out in the house. It was the summer of 1954, and several months had gone by, so he had moved there in the spring of 54, I guess.
All right.
And several months had gone by. I was quite happy about my move to Seattle. It was a new place to live in, larger than Portland. I began to feel like I was a part of the life that was there. After some time, Grace became a bit on edge. There seemed to be a little bickering going on among some of the principals that were involved in the center. That would be Phyllis, Marie, Grace, and Nellie. This is a common occurrence in the setting of an ashram.
By the way, when we get a chance, I got to take a break and go to the bathroom.
Okay. We could do that in a second here. Okay?
Okay.
Yeah, we'll be finished.
Make it quick.
Yeah. So there seemed to be a little bickering going on among some of the principals that were involved in the center. This is a common occurrence in the setting of an ashram. I was doing my best to keep things under control, but one by one, the key players were coming to me with their tales of woe. Grace seemed to be overstepping her role and was finding fault with some of the members. I felt a bit uneasy with what I perceived as a coming storm that would soon be upon.
Now, do you want to just hold on until
That's good.
All right.
So, he says, the overall attendance at the center was very good, not at all like Portland. A prophet has no honor in his homeland, I thought. Most of the people that came wanted to see some phenomena or mind reading or telling the future. They wanted to find some form of security in love, money, or other things. The class in self-knowledge was smaller, as no one was really interested in discovering who or what they really were. Phyllis Goodall had me hold a series of private readings with her about the future of the work at the center. The center was not all positive about certain aspects, I guess, based on the readings. The right kind of people had not yet gathered or come in contact with Robert. That's what the trance said. There was more work to be done, not the psychic or mental kind, but in the arena of self-knowledge. So one day, a woman named Elsie, who was a student of Ramana Maharishi, shows up. She wanted a series of private readings with me to help her. She also wanted to stay at the center for some time and write about my abilities. So here was the potential of a book being written about him. It was okay with me, but for the others, this was the straw that broke the camel's back. Grace didn't like her, didn't like Elsie. She thought that Elsie was trying to take over. Elsie was a bit pushy, but I could handle her all right. What I didn't know was that Grace was seeing another teacher who was giving her mescaline. You remember that? What's that mean to you?
Well, I think Elliot Craig.
Ah, yes, like who could get mescaline in Seattle in 54? I mean, isn't that hard to get?
I don't know.
All right, so you're thinking later of the Elliot Craig, the CIA guy. Okay, good. What I didn't know was that Grace was seeing another... So that's new for you, right? That she was getting mescaline at that point in 54.
Yeah, although I'm not surprised.
Okay.
Because of her connections...
She was in the OSS.
Which we'll get into. I see whether he mentioned some of the other things or not.
Yeah, she was in the OSS. We mentioned that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I don't think he...
He does not mention that at all in the book, but let's just go along here. What I didn't know was that Grace was seeing... I had not seen the image of that. That's pretty interesting, the mescaline and Elliot Craig CIA connection.
Possible.
Yeah. What I didn't know was that Grace was seeing another teacher who was giving her mescaline. One day, Grace came in to tell me about her experiences with the drug. My response was to tell her that drugs only gave a temporary high and were not the real thing. She wanted a reading. The advice that came out of me was very similar. Interesting. Said the same thing. Along with a warning that she was too fragile to play with her mind, you know, with drugs. This proved to be true as she began to show signs of mental breakdown. Now, based on what you've said to me, Dave, she's involved with you later. Isn't she the one who gets you?
I was never involved with her. I just knew about her.
Oh, yes, Geraldine Morse, who wants you to trance in 67.
Yeah, that's way down the line. It's Grace Chapman. The only thing... she came up as a reference later was, you remember Lucille and Miriam?
Yes.
Well, Miriam...
I met them.
...was at an earlier stage in, 1954?
Yeah.
And Grace Chapman and Elliot Craig... did things with her. Maybe she even had mescaline. She didn't know, but she was wandering around the streets downtown, not knowing what she was doing.
That's Lucille.
No,
great.
Miriam.
Oh, Miriam reports that back before...
And so apparently somebody... Stan Collins was involved, too.
Yeah, so we're talking about Elliot Craig and Stan Collins, Lucille Ryman and Miriam... What's her last name?
LaParne.
What is it?
LaParne,
okay. Four people.
As well as let's see. You mentioned Stan Collins.
Elliot Craig.
And Grace Chapman were involved in trying to work therapy with LaParne.
With Miriam.
They couldn't do anything about it except that I guess they gave, she's one of the first I heard that got Carbogen. They gave her Carbogen. That's the first use I'd heard of. Later it came into big play, but the Carbogen, and it only worked part way, but it was enough for Craig to work hypnosis with her and tell her to forget about everything that they had done and to go ahead and live a regular life. And that's after that's where she was running around the streets for quite a while. And it wasn't until she met Lucille and had some therapy with her that she kind of straightened out.
And that,
so
would
that
be,
was a long period of time.
And but that, what you're just describing, is before you show up at the Center of Integration.
Yeah, I didn't even know Laparne had done this till much later. It was probably 1966.
When you found out.
Yeah, and that I found out when we were at a Baba Ram Dass.
Richard Alpert at that point.
Richard Alpert was there as Richard Alpert. This
yeah.
was before he became Robert. And we saw him in 66, and all of us were there in the U District somewhere.
Right, and here's what's interesting. You say that Stan and Elliot, not Lucille, Stan and Elliot, or at least Stan is working with, Stan and Elliot are working with Miriam Laparne, right? Trying
with
to help her.
Grace Chapman.
Oh, and Grace
and
Chapman.
Miriam Laparne was the subject.
Right, because what's interesting is it's Lucille Raymond and Stan Collins who
much later
triggered Doobie into cosmic awareness.
That's right. In other words, here was the first thing I know of Stan Collins, but I wasn't there. Then later he did come to the Center of Integration and lecture on hypnosis, and that was in the earliest stage before the LSD.
Before you took LSD in 57.
Yeah.
And Stan is part of the CIA at that point?
Well, from the get-go, you
okay.
know.
All right.
There's a long story about him.
Yeah, maybe we'll do that later, but that's the point. You've got CIA people playing with Miriam Laparne.
Yeah.
And Grace is part of that. Yeah, that's the point.
Yeah.
Grace. So
now
yeah.
this what I figure is Grace may have gotten the setup in the house and started doing some stuff, and Bob moved, and in the meantime, some of the things they did included Miriam Laparne. That's all I can figure, is that Chapman was doing that later, after Bob had moved.
Right.
And Bob was not privy to all of that.
That's right.
Maybe just some of it, but I don't know.
Right, but that's very. I can see why you went woo when I said what I didn't know was that Grace was seeing another teacher who was giving her mescaline. That could be the whole CIA gang there.
Yep.
So that's a useful little tidbit there from Bob for you just to get clarity
yeah,
about
yeah.
what happened. Okay, he says. So he tells her this proved to be true as she began to show signs of mental breakdown. Could you say that about her? When you met her, that she had signed?
I didn't know her. I never met Grace
okay.
that I know of.
All right.
That Grace. I've met other Graces, but not
yeah.
that one.
Okay. In addition to these issues with Grace, Elsie's presence was creating jealousy among some of the people in the inner circle. I was learning quickly about the problems of running a center full of women. The Vedanta... I forgot to laugh. the thing was that I immediately started to say while you were laughing that it was the women who caused the problem at the Vedanta Center for him. It was another factor why he had to leave. So he's having the own experience of women around a male guru causing a problem. So that's what I wanted to cite.
As well as having something to say about a board and everything else. That's why he had the laws of the and the precepts of the Center of Integration in such a way that he could not be, he as the founder and et cetera, he had the power, nobody could take it away, that anybody else that came in was officers were subject to his. So he's like a little dictator of a corporation, if you wanted to put it that strongly, but that's pushing it too far. It was just protection, not to have this. In other words, he'd gone through one thing before, and he'd gone through another thing before, and let's do it so it, I don't have to go through this anymore.
And he actually does say that a couple pages later, as you'll see.
Is that right?
Yeah, he implies that. It's pretty... So you're right on.
Well, I'm right on.
You're right on, Dave. I was learning quickly about the problems of running a center full of women. I thought, what have I got myself into? I called a secret meeting of the core group, that would be Phyllis and,
yeah.
and Grace, I guess, and laid out to them the problems and conflicts that I saw occurring. As Grace was the owner of the present house, everyone agreed that we need to move and find a new home. The quicker, the better. A committee was formed to find a place. It happened in 2 days.
Wow. Yeah.
Now, you're saying there was this financial thing you said a little while ago that was a factor?
Well, I don't know. I know that that may, but he took care of the financial thing of taking the money out of the bank, and I guess she was very angry about that, I heard.
Whose money was it?
Apparently it was the money of the center, but maybe it had a joint account, and he just took it out and then put it over into the other center. He says, it's the center.
Right, right. And this is just stuff you heard later in gossip talk or something. It wasn't a big deal, or maybe it was a big issue, people talking about it at later?
Well, I think it was like, well, and you know what happened, and then it's almost like gossip, except sometimes it's a literal recitation of the truthful movements of each step, and especially if you have two or three correcting each other while they're talking, you know?
Yeah, and now Grace, as far as you know, wasn't part of the Ralph Doobie movement?
Doobie? No, I don't think so.
So she disappears. She disappears in your experience.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so he says, in 2 days, one of the ladies knew of a large house near the Theosophical Library. So they meet with the guy, and it's Phyllis Goodall, Marie, Hawk, and myself. So that's the core, Phyllis and Marie, not Grace or Nellie or Elsie. They meet with the guy. His name is Mr. Johnson. Does that mean anything to you? Mr. Johnson?
I think Johnson owned the place.
Yeah, he was the owner. Mr. Johnson is the owner. Said that he would have a lease drawn up for signing the next day. Their problem was solved, and ours as well, because he wanted to sell it pretty quickly. So, listen to this description, because this is where you were. We now had a great place in which to create a new home and center. The house was in a corner, with only one house next door. But he uses that phrase throughout the book. What's it mean to be in a corner? Is it like a dead-end street or something? Or?
No, it's like on a corner. So that you had access from two streets.
Ah, no, it's not in a corner.
And the house next door that he's referring to was a big mansion that was the lot was a little bit lower, so we kind of looked over it. Now there were other houses, but I guess that side he just didn't count them as they were just a bunch of houses.
Right. So he's in a corner. It's on a corner. He writes it as in a corner. Okay.
Well,
the house was on a corner with only one house next door. There were other houses next door, but they weren't. They were away or a bit removed or something?
Well, it just faces a different direction.
Right, okay. There were three floors. You agree with that?
Yes, I think there was a basement, two floors, and a fourth floor. In other words, it's three floors if you don't count the basement.
Right. He says there were three floors, a large basement within an apartment.
See? And that apartment is the one I had.
Yeah, and a carriage house at the end of the driveway in the back.
Yeah, which had an apartment over it.
Okay, so you had four floors counting the basement.
Yeah, and the second floor of the garage.
Yeah. The front steps led up to a solid door with a stained glass window.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to bring back, maybe you already have these images, but I'm trying to spark your memory.
Oh, yeah.
And there was a side entrance with a driveway where one could park four or five cars.
Let's see. Well, there was a side driveway that you could park two or three in because it curved in. You could get two or three parked there. But then there was the main driveway that went back to the garage that was, you know, quite long. So, yeah, that's essentially as he sees it.
Yeah, there was a carriage house at the end of the driveway in the back. That's the back, the driveway goes in the back. And then there was a side entrance with the driveway. So it's sort of like another driveway, but it was a curve.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe not four or five cars, maybe two or three, right?
There, but then there's four or five that could park in the long drive from Broadway back to the carriage house.
Right. Now, is this building still there?
Oh, yeah.
I'll have to go get a picture of it.
It's probably a bed and breakfast. I'm not sure.
Okay. What part of Seattle is this? I don't know Seattle that well, but lived there, but what?
Capitol Hill.
But where is that? I only know the University of Washington area, basically.
All right. If you went south of the University of Washington over the bridge, and then you jogged a little bit east and up the hill, St. Mark's Cathedral, you know where that was? It was up on Capitol Hill. It was only a few blocks from where we were.
Okay, so when we were at Eastern Avenue, we'd look out from the hill there across the water. We would be seeing Capitol Hill across the water?
You could have probably seen St. Mark's Cathedral from there.
Okay, yeah.
And then it would have been near there.
Right, so it was opposite where we lived in Eastern Avenue.
Yeah, it's up the hill. In other words, as the freeway comes by, it's way up the hill, over the higher than the freeway, 100, 200 feet. You had to go, you know, that's why you didn't have much egress from the freeway unless you got in down at the southern part of Capitol Hill or the northern part of Capitol Hill that you could go up and be on Capitol Hill.
Right, I got you now.
It's a bohemian style neighborhood from way back.
Okay. He says the kitchen had two gas ranges and three refrigerators. That's big.
Yeah. Does he talk about the little room with the copper sink?
Oh, he says the next sentence, there were two pantries and a staircase in the back that led up to the second floor where there were five bedrooms and a large enclosed porch off the main bedroom.
Yeah.
It's a huge place, right?
Yeah, and that porch got enclosed for Biff, the monkey.
He talks about Biff later, yeah. The top floor had a ballroom. A ballroom?
Well, I guess it was, could be a ballroom. It was had slanted eaves and was big space.
Yeah, okay.
Bob and Connie moved up there and lived for a time, and then at a later point, Doobie lived up there.
Okay. It says the top floor had a ballroom and two bedrooms with a bath. The home had just the right atmosphere for our needs. He then had a meeting with... Does that bring back the image for you?
Yeah, except I forgot that the top floor had another couple bedrooms and a bath up there, too.
Yeah. I forgot. Okay, it means his memory's correct. You now remember that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I then had a meeting with Grace and told her how I felt, that things were not working out. I told her that I decided not to stay in her house any longer and that I found a new place and would be moving out in a week. I felt that she was glad that I was leaving. So she kind of drops off at that point. We had made a mistake, and that was that. Elsie had left in a huff, and I was relieved. Also, Nellie and I had a long talk. She thought she wanted to return to Portland. She wanted to start working again by opening a new shop. Big changes for everybody. Phyllis wanted a reading on the new plan to see what the future might be. I agreed. So a small group was called in to take part. This reminds me so much of the Cosmic Awareness Days. Okay, we have something that has to be dealt with. Let's have a reading. Okay, so a small group was called in to take part. What came out was most interesting, something like this. So I guess this is his memory, or it's a faulty tape. But here's the quote. Here's what's said. The forces are subject to those who take part in the new environment. All that happens is a reflection of consciousness, and that is ever-changing, according to those who make up the activities of a group. Thought is the building block of matter, and the two are not separate. Each and every person brings to the group a mixture of their past deeds and the opportunities for a new expression. All right, that's the quote. What do you think of that? Just general?
Well, that's very good motivation. I probably heard that, but it's like I was new into all that when I came in. And
what do you mean, probably heard that? What does that mean? You weren't there for
Well,
that.
I think I may have seen some of the laws and what do they call them? I said precepts.
Precepts,
but
yeah. They...
But anyway, the thing the lawyers set out and the officers and et cetera, when they made me president, actually, they just asked me if I would be president, and I became president.
Okay, yeah. just a minute. I had to switch phones. And mine was losing its battery. Okay, you there? Everybody there?
Yes.
So you're saying, why did you, okay, this quote, why did you talk about become president in reference to this quote? The forces are subject to those who take part in the new environment. And then you mentioned lawyers. What's that about?
Well, in other words, when he left Chapman and went to lawyers to get the proper form for his incorporating the thing, this reading probably played a factor in it.
I see.
And I think I saw something of that effect when I saw the notes, the file with the laws and precepts of the corporation.
When you were president?
When they asked me to be president, I looked it over first and et cetera, and I agreed to be. And I said, well, are you going to vote? He said, it's all right.
Okay, so here, that is discussed in the next page you'll see. But just he's talking about making the new place. He says, after a week of cleaning, we painted and rearranged everything and advertised 3 rooms for rent to help pay for the cost of running the house. My father was reassigned to work in Seattle for a construction company, so he said he would take the master bedroom. Did you ever hear about that?